Welcome to the Egyptian Streets podcast. I'm your host, Noron Morsi, writer and podcast producer at Egyptian Streets. Each week, we invite a notable Egyptian to talk with us as we explore the intersection between Egyptian identity and creative social change from an artistic, educational, or cultural perspective. Today, joining me as co-host is Amina Zineddine, writer at Egyptian Streets, and Mohammed Khairat, editor-in-chief.
Hi everyone, my name is Mohammed Khairat. We're all very excited today at the Egyptian Streets podcast team to be hosting Bassem Youssef, a man who I believe needs no introduction. But Amina, please tell us a bit about Bassem Youssef.
So yeah, like Mohammed said, he is someone who needs no real introduction because we all know him very well from especially from the period of time where he did the Bernamek El Bernamek, which was the political satire program that he spent a lot of time doing in Egypt. It became one of the most watched programs in Egypt. But since then, he's really sort of spread out his portfolio, and he's doing a lot of different things regarding nutrition and fitness and health. And he's also actually a trained surgeon. So he's a person with a very varied portfolio and a very interesting character to converse with.
Stay tuned. Bassem Youssef, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of Egyptian Streets. I have it on my timeline the whole time on Facebook.
That's great to hear.
Thank you very much, Bassem.
I think just to start, I mean, I think we've already established that we all know who you are, but in your own words, how would you introduce yourself?
Well, I think after 19 years of being in the medical field, the first thing that comes to mind is being a doctor. I don't think I'm still very comfortable of describing myself as a comedian or a satirist because it's only the last 9 years of my life. And also when you describe yourself as a comedian, people say, all right, tell us something funny. Or maybe people don't agree that you're funny enough. So there's this kind of insecurity of describing yourself of being a comedian. But when you say, hey, I'm a doctor, that kind of like shuts everyone off. And it's kind of, yeah, I'm a doctor. I don't need to prove it because if I have to prove it, I have to open up your chest.
Yeah. And would you say this part, I guess, is, you know, becoming or discovering your comedic side is part of what we're going to discuss a bit later today, reinventing yourself, or was it not necessarily intentional?
I don't know if it was intentional. I was kind of like, I always feared of putting myself in a position where I have to make people laugh because when they don't, it's very painful. So I think I dealt with the whole El Bernamek experience or the whole political satire experience as a job. I kind of like dissected it. I studied it as much as possible, and I dealt with it as a vehicle in order to produce a show that will be different. So I never went on stage thinking I'm funny, I'm gonna make people laugh, as much as we are going to create a quality kind of show where people will enjoy it, and of course having people laugh is an addition. But I think I approached the whole experience of having the political satire show the same way as I approached medicine, studying imitation and execution. This is what you do with surgery. You imitate the senior surgeon next to you. So we imitated at the beginning. And I remember when we, at the very, very, very beginning, when we were recruiting parts of the team, like the writers, the director, I would like sit them down and I make them watch hours of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, and I said, like, this is what we want to do. And of course, we managed to have a different product because we are not like the Daily Show. It's a different show. We had people like dancing. It was an hour show, not a 20-minute show. It was, and I think it was also part of like letting everybody achieve their potential in the show, and I'm kind of like proud of my team because I think one of the things that bothered me in Egyptian television is that there's only that one person who is the anchor, and everybody is kind of like they fall around him. And I think I decided to give everybody a kind of an ownership in the show. And the ownership comes with that, like, you give people their own creative space. And they would, and if you do that, you will be surprised of how amazing they would be creative. And I think that's why the show has always been a symbol of what a collective effort could look like.
In one of the conversations I watched you have, you talked about how not many people knew the personal pressure you put on yourself during the creation of El Bernamig and how much weight that would hold on you and how important flexibility became to you in that process. Could you share a bit more about that?
Yes. When people look at influencers on the internet, TV stars, celebrities in general, and then all they look at is the reach. Like, oh my God, he's got like 40 million people watching the show. This is what they see. And this is like how many million views this video makes. And this is very, that's kind of like the glamorous side of it. But when you're in it, you discover what kind of pressure. When you say like, oh my God, 40 million people are watching me. But on the other side, I say, oh my God, 40 million people has an opinion about me. And it's crazy. It's crazy to be under that kind of pressure. I don't deny that sometime when we did a good job, we enjoyed it. But in the same time, the kind of pressure that this kind of viewership, of this kind of anticipation creates was crazy. Especially when the political climate in Egypt changed and everybody was waiting, anticipating to see what you're going to say. And if you said it, maybe it's not strong enough. And if it's strong enough, it's not funny enough. And if it's funny enough, it's not satisfying enough. Or it doesn't agree with their opinions enough. And that created a crazy kind of pressure on me. And of course, on the whole team. The other part of the question, which is about the flexibility, happened after the show. Because as much as the show was an amazing part of my life, I couldn't do anything else while doing the show. And when the era of the show kind of ended, it kind of like, it made me think about how can I be flexible enough to be in a position where I can recreate or reinvent myself doing other things. And there was kind of like a period of like a limbo where I didn't know what to do. And I started to kind of explore other potentials. And I'm still doing that. And it's a very interesting, rewarding and scary and annoying experiment all at once.
So I think, something you mentioned earlier, Bessem, was you wanted to make people laugh. And that journey that you just described seems quite, you know, stressful, had a lot of pressures, it had a lot of negativity. Who made you laugh in your day-to-day life? What kept you going?
Well, it's I think it's different. I mean, I think all of us, we have different people that makes us laugh in different phases of our lives, right? What taste kind of evolves, right? So, of course, like any Egyptian, as I was growing up, you know, Adil Imam, Samir Ghanem, Fouad Mohandes, those people were kind of like the people that that made you laugh. And as you grow, you do develop a kind of a different taste. I think I kind of like gravitated more towards Western kind of comedy. I think one of my favorites is George Carlin. And George Carlin is just brilliant. And he's not that kind of... maybe it's a little bit of a kind of a subversive kind of comedy, and it's more of a like a comedic rant as much more than a comedy. I think like your taste in comedy kind of evolves as you go, and maybe tomorrow it will be something new.
Yeah, you mentioned that you sat yourself and your team down to watch how Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, etc., did what they were doing, and I was wondering how it was kind of working with these people that initially, I mean, you worked with Jon Stewart, and how was that experience, you know, after initially kind of looking towards them as the head surgeon and then
being in the same room with that head surgeon working?
So when I showed my team those videos of John Stewart and Stephen Colbert, it was not kind of imitating their human as much as like imitating the style of how you cut into the videos and how the show looks like. So it was more kind of like technical. When I visited the Daily Show headquarters in New York, it was interesting to see what I kind of like, I was amazed about is like how the, it was the sequence of how they would come and create the show on a daily basis. So at 8 o'clock in the morning, the whole team is in one room, including the host, John Stewart or Trevor Noah now, and they will sit down and all they would do for like 2 hours is just like talk about like the events of the day. They would bring on videos. Sometimes they would kind of like say, this is what happened. And there was like someone on the side writing everything, like a transcript. And they would just like bounce idea, just like talk. And it's kind of like the one thing that I learned is that not about like, what is your immediate joke, but what is your immediate feeling? If you see this piece of news, how do you feel about it? And from there, it would the whole theme, the whole joke, the whole comedy will evolve. And for them, I asked them, and this is something like, for example, the people in Egypt got hooked up. The people in Egypt are hooked to the videos. Mm-hmm. But in the Daily Show and the Colbert, like the videos are not important. It's what you want to do with it. And that's why until now, people come and they cut my show and they take videos and they kind of cut it around. And I say, that's not that. And I tell people, it is not about the videos. It's what you do between from one video to the other. What is the overarching method? There was sometimes, for example, where I would have the editors or the writers compile like very funny videos for me. And I said, like, yeah, that's funny, but it doesn't say anything.
What am I going to do with it?
What is the message? Yeah, mm-hmm. People would laugh when they see the videos, but I'm not really doing anything about it, right? Mm.
And letting the videos do the work.
Yeah, and because of that, why don't we just like edit it and just like put it on the internet and just remove me from the middle? And that's, I think that is a lot of people who, the big mistakes of many of the people who try to do the same thing is just that they just focus on not editing the videos, making it as funny as possible, which is great. But then what are you doing as a host from one video to the other? You're not doing anything, basically.
When you were describing the methods that you used when you were creating your comedy show and what you learned from being in the room, in the headquarters of the Daily Show in New York, the lessons that you're describing are, I think, lessons that can be transferred onto other things that you create as a creative person. And I was wondering, in the process of reinventing yourself, what lessons did you learn from each phase that you could transfer onto the next phase, basically?
Yeah. So, for example, now I'm doing stand-up comedy, which is something completely new for me. And mm-hmm. it's the same thing. It is watching, imitating, and executing. And then mm-hmm. trying to surround yourself with the right people. So when I started doing the stand-up comedy, here in America, the beauty about it is that you can have some kind of a residency. There's a lot of venues that can actually give you time where you work on your material. And I worked with American writers, American stand-up comedians. So you also surround yourself with the people who know the craft and you learn a lot from them, and then you imitate and then you take it and you make it your own. So basically that is actually the main arc of trying to create something new, even if you don't know what it is in the beginning. So it is imitating, learning, surrounding yourself with the right people, and then making it your own at the end.
Would anyone ever see you at a local comedy show in America, or do you mostly try to go to, you know, larger events, larger comedy shows and festivals?
Oh no, I do a lot of local stuff. I mean, you'll laugh. Just the last couple of days, I actually did a comedy show in a flower shop. 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
that's so nice.
Yeah, so the owner of the show of the shop said, like, you know, they invited family and friends, and I went there to try material, and I wasn't alone. I was like with two, three other comedians. One of them is Ahmed, of course, who you know from the Axis of Evil a long time ago, and one of them is called Eddie Eft, which is like huge in Australia. And you have those people who are used to theaters, and they come in and they work up the material in front of like 6 or 7 people. right?
That's so wholesome.
Yeah, and the thing is, the beauty about it is that there, I think there is, there's an unwritten rule of comedy. A smaller room is much difficult to lift than a bigger room. A bigger room is light. A small room is very heavy, because you have to gauge the energy of those few people and get them engaged the whole time. And you don't have the reward of like 100 people laughing. You have just 6 or 7 people. So every great comedian does that. You will find at the time, you will find like Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy going into like very late at 2 o'clock in the morning in the Comedy Store or the Laugh Factory, doing his material in front of 5 or 10 people. And it is what makes you a better comedian, lifting a smaller room. So yeah, you have to work on your craft the whole time.
And speaking of your stand-up comedy, I think it would be really interesting for you to tell us how different audiences respond to you, because you're going around the US and you're also going around Europe and all of these things. And sometimes, I guess, your audience are Americans, sometimes there are Egyptian or Arab audiences. Can you tell us a little bit about how the interaction looks with the different audiences?
Yeah, that's very interesting, because sometimes you have like a room, a very mixed room, like 50% Arabs, 50% Americans, and certain jokes work with certain parts of the room. So you feel like the laughter coming from different parts of the room depending on the joke, you know? And it's like, oh, that joke works better with Americans, and even an Egyptian or Arab who have been here for 30 years is different from someone who has been here for just 5 years. So it's kind of like the show. It is very refreshing to see how the people kind of react. Especially, there's many Egyptians who have never set foot in a comedy club before. And many Egyptians who come who think they're going to see El Bernami. Or sometimes they even come and they're surprised, why is it in English? Because we're in America. So it's been very interesting. And sometimes people will be disappointed. Oh, I came here for El Bernami. I want to see you. Why are you not speaking in Arabic? It's like, it's because it's a different thing now. But sometimes when the night is good, it's good. It works.
Like, even if they have different expectations, they're like, oh wait, I like this new thing. This is
and
good.
Sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
You can never please everyone.
Of course, of course.
Would you like to see more comedy theaters in Egypt? You mentioned some Egyptians had never stepped foot in a comedy club.
Well, there was an amazing experience in the maybe 15 years ago with Muga Comedy, when, you know, people like, you know, George Azmi, who's like absolutely amazing, came out and did the show, their shows, and it was good. It was a start and then kind of died. And then they're kind of trying to recreating it. And then we know what happened in the last couple of weeks when a guy did a joke that didn't kind of appeal to some people, when he was making fun of a certain... radio show, a radio station.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it is great, of course, to have comedy clubs. But you have to understand that comedy is also part of the general environment, right? And I get this a lot from international comedians. Like, yeah. I was invited to Egypt, but they always told me, don't make fun of, don't do any jokes about like religion, politics, or sex. It's like, what is left?
What am I supposed to joke about now?
These are the three big taboos, and because they are taboos, when you make fun of the taboos, people laugh, and that's why the comedy become the most domesticated and tamed and lame, and then people is like, you know, they complain, ah, it's not that funny. I was like, well, we're putting all of these restrictions on people. How do you expect them to be funny? So basically, you're giving people just like a very, very small margin of what they can talk about. And the thing about comedy, it should be liberated. So I think the question is much bigger than, should we have more comedy clubs in Egypt? I think the question has to come to deal with the environment in Egypt.
And I do think that's unfortunate. Because, like, you know, like we saw with El Bernamic, but also outside Egypt, you know, we've seen how comedy is not only a way to make people laugh, but also to make people think about important stories, about important issues, and to drive people to, you know, take action, whether it's in relation to environmental issues, social issues, political issues.
That's great. But sometimes comedy have absolutely no meaning but making people laugh. I mean, you can go to the late night shows at the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory, and people are just like doing very sexual content that does not really make you think about anything that make you crack laughing. And that's fine. You know, that's fine. You know, if you will have people doing, you will have like a lineup of like 10 people, and some people will just like talk about like, oh, yesterday I met this girl at a bar, and like the whole set is about, is very sexual, very offending even, but people laugh, and it doesn't matter because they're, and then somebody else will come and talk about racism, and then the third one will talk about politics, and then the fourth one will talk about his family. I don't think we should hold people to a standard. Well, if you're going to make a comedy, you have to make it important or make people think. It's comedy, you know, and if you don't like it, just don't watch it, just skip. We shouldn't have the whole thing about like putting standards of like what should be said and not be said. It's the death of comedy, and I think it's like the whole mindset of like what should be said and not be said, it will have to change before saying, should we have comedy clubs where we are from or not, you know?
Yeah, and there's this kind of danger of turning comedians into, or not danger really, but this expectation of turning comedians into maybe activists or journalists or something. And I know of a lot of, comedians that have had to say, I'm like, especially political satires, especially in programs that have a similar format to El Bernamic, who have had to come out and say, I'm not a journalist. You can't hold me to that standard.
Yeah, and guess who said that too? Me. I said that on my show many times. I said, guys, you just like, put too much weight on El Bernamic. And I think I understand where it comes from, because when you are living in an environment where everybody else around you is failing, politics and journalism, whatever, people turn to comedians because they're the only one who's good at their jobs. They're making you laugh. So they're the only one who's actually doing their job right. But then they take that, and then they want you to be the forerunner of some activism or some cause. And comedians says, guys, like, our role ends at the edge of the theater or the edge of your TV screen. One of the biggest criticisms that was directed to me is like, oh, you كنت عامل نفسك مناضل. You were like you as if like you pretended to be a freedom fighter. I never said that, not in my show. And I explicitly said on the show, guys, this is a comedy show, and if you are going to treat it any different, that's your problem, not ours. But people have this idea; they want just like they want to put you in that position the whole time to cover for the failure of the other people that they look up to. And it is dangerous. And in the States, people, and I think everywhere in the world, people like are frustrated, and they kind of express their frustration on the comedians, because we're the weakest link, basically, if you think about it. We cannot put you in jail. We don't have any power over you. So instead of them actually dealing with the main problem, they lash at you.
Yeah, and I think something that you've said before that's really powerful is comedy is not your savior, and it comes in handy a lot, but it's definitely not what we should be targeting any need for change towards.
Yeah, comedy is not your savior. You should not use comedy as a crutch to deal with your own problems. It can, you know, it can entertain you. It can make you think if you want. And there is like a very, you know, very famous saying, it's like prayer doesn't change people. Prayer change people and people change. Prayer doesn't change things. Prayer change people and people change things, you know. You need to deal with comedy the same way. It is just a tool to make you maybe, it can make you just laugh. It can make you think. It can make you relax. But really, it can help you understand what's going on around you if you want to. But that's it. It is really up to you.
Is it safe to say then that, I guess, how El Bernemeg was received, and I don't want to dwell onto this too much because I'm sure you've spoken about this a lot in the past, but, you know, how El Bernemeg was received by the population and how, you know, ended up being instrumental for many people at a certain time was beyond your initial expectations and beyond your mission or your intentions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the El Bernemeg, I mean, a lot of people forget that the, part of the success of the Bernemeg was the era, the environment that was around it, right? I mean, I don't
the
think
context.
But also the era there were the or the circumstances that the whole country was going through. I mean, if I come now and do the Bernemeg, I don't think it will be that successful because there are certain things around it that make it successful. It was like a whole mood in the world. People kind of like received it at the beginning. Oh, that's different. And then people started to become polarized around it, especially when different political power became in control of the country. So the people who liked me before didn't like me because now I was making fun of the people that they like and vice versa. So I think people kind of like took it personal. And I took it as a political statement, and they even like made up things that like I'm a part of like a bigger agenda and I'm being paid to say that, and that never stopped. But at the end of the, and that is the pressure that was on El Bernemeg in itself, and I guess again it comes back to the fact that people kind of channeled their frustration and their anger towards a show that was supposed to be a comedy show. But that's not unique to Egypt. I mean, a lot of people hate Jon Stewart, yeah, like people on the right wing, you know. A lot of people hate the liberal comedians because they don't align with their beliefs, and that's the problem with political comedy.
Did this kind of pressure and all of these expectations, did that contribute to your desire to kind of widen your portfolio, because you're doing a lot of things alongside comedy now?
Widening my portfolio had to come to became as a result of where I am right now. Mm-hmm. It would be stupid to come like, all right, I was the host of the most popular show in Egypt, and then I'll come. Hey, I'm gonna be the host of a similar popular show in America. The market here is already saturated. It would be very stupid for me to come here and try to compete with Trevor Noah or John Oliver or Stephen Colbert, who have been doing that for years. And what you do is to try to find a niche. What can you do here? So widening the portfolio is trying to find different niches in order to express yourself differently. So that portfolio comes from as it came organically, and I think it would not be the wise thing to come and try to recreate the same exact experiment that had its own certain circumstances in Egypt and try to do it in America. So that is why the portfolio here is different.
So speaking about widening portfolios and also, you know, moving on from, you know, you're mentioning comedy and politics and wasn't all intended. Now you're doing something what many people would consider completely different, even though it's actually been something that you're passionate about for many years. You've had a YouTube channel, but you're starting a new show about healthy lifestyle, veganism. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how you ended up from, you know, doing YouTube episodes, posting about it on Instagram, to a show on a large Middle East, or a new, but I think large Middle East?
Well, when I started as a personal experience. I had a friend of mine, Nader, he had MS, and he kind of like was able to control his disease and symptoms when he went to a plant-based diet. And for me, to as a doctor, hearing someone kind of putting MS under control was amazing for me, because for us, MS is the boogeyman in medicine. And I started to read and educate myself about it, and I adopted the lifestyle. So I didn't think about making this into a show or anything, but like then people started asking me about advice, and I started to help them, and then they became better, and then I started, you know what, maybe there is a good idea where I started being plant-based when I was in Egypt. That was in 2013, so there was like a whole year when I was still doing the show and I'm being plan-based. So it didn't come like, all right, I can do the show now. Now let's do the plan-based. It was always there, but people forget. So, and then I thought of like, maybe I can actually turn this into a bigger opportunity to reach more people. So I did a website, I did the videos, and I started to educate people about it. And then I thought, maybe there is like a place for this, to put that on television. And then there's a place to this, to make this as a kind of an opportunity, a business opportunity, in order to help people on a bigger scale. Because here's the thing, if you want something to continue, good intentions are not enough. You need to have money and power behind it. And money and power comes in the force of, like, you know, investment, coming in the form of having people interested to put that on their channel. So it kind of evolved. I didn't think about it at the beginning, but I think when people kind of, when I found there is a need for it, and people would be willing to follow it and even be part of it, this is how I developed myself into creating the show on the internet, then on television, and now I'm actually about to launch the second version of the Plan B website, where people can actually go in and have personalized coaching and personalized medical consultation in order to face their chronic diseases. And I kind of like, I had this comparison in my head, you know, in the 1970s, everybody was making fun of the electric car. And you know, electric car versus fossil fuel. Now nobody's making fun of electric cars, because people like Elon Musk, or because those people got the investment, got the people excited about it. So at the beginning they would make fun of it, but now they're not. And it's about like dealing with it. It's kind of like creating the demand, making people aware of what's there, what's the potential that they can achieve. And this is how my new passion is have actually came to materialize.
Go for it, Amina.
I'm just really, really curious to for you to kind of give us a bit of a quick sneak peek into the kind of life that you lead, because this is something pretty personal to you. You are taking it further, but it's quite personal. For a lot of Egyptians, this is like الأكل الأرضي. It's something very strange and unfamiliar. And I feel it would be really cool if you gave us a little snapshot of what does this entail? What does this Plan B lifestyle entail?
So we try to shy away from the word veganism, because veganism has a much more political and social meaning, you know. A mistake that a lot of people do is that they put us in the same box as vegan activists. Now, with all due respect, I mean, veganism is much more about like animal cruelty, about like it's an ethical choice, which I totally respect. And after 7 years of being vegan, or plant-based, I now see that we don't need to kill animals. But that's not my main message. My main message is a very selfish message of you being better. So I tell people, hey, if you eat a steak and a burger and you feel fine, it's great. It's amazing. Go ahead. But if you have a medical problem and you want to change your life, maybe there is another option. And that's why the name came, you know, have a plant, a Plan B, a Plant B, try plants. That's where the name came from. I myself, I am not 100% plant-based. I am a 98% plant-based, which means that sometimes I would, you know, I would eat a cheese sandwich every now and then. I would eat a tuna sandwich every now and then. It's not the end of the world. It's not a cult. But as the more I stay in the lifestyle, the less inclined that I would try something that is not plant-based, because my body kind of like gets used to 100% plant-based much better. But yeah, I indulge every now and then. It's not the end of the world. It's not a cult. I tell people it's what you do 90% of the time. And if you're sick, maybe it's better to do it 100% of the time and then go back and indulge every now and then. So that's why I tell people it's not the end of the world, guys. Like, but I can't stop eating, I don't know, chicken or fish. It's like, fine, do changes in other areas, and then do that when you're ready. So it is about like, I think it's not about the lifestyle as much as like thinking about what you eat. Understanding is not everything that you thought were healthy is healthy, and try to kind of like have healthier choice to you and your children. And and at the end of the day, it's what makes you happy and healthy. So that's it. It's a very, very, it's not as difficult as you think. And yes.
Are your kids plant-based as well?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's el akl urdihi. I think the whole idea about akl urdihi, it's kind of like we got used so much to having animal products in our on our table that we don't think that there's another way. And I think when you get used to it, you actually find it a very rewarding lifestyle.
On that note, who, like, so far from, you know, the people who are watching your videos, asking you questions, following your website, and the people who will be watching your new show, who has been the main audience so far? Have you had a significant audience from the Middle East or from Egypt? Or
yeah, most of the audience is from the Middle East. The vast majority are from Egypt. And also the vast majority of critics are from Egypt, as usual. So I think one of the things that I had to train myself in accepting is that you just focus on the positive feedback, because you'll always have those people, demeaning it, criticizing it, making fun of it. But then when you read comments or messages where people tell you, both of my parents were diabetic, and because of your show, they're not taking diabetes medicine anymore. They got their diabetes under control. Or when someone said, I've been 3 months plant based, and that's the best decision I had in my life. When you have these messages, this is the stuff that makes you go on. This is the stuff that makes you going, because you know that you're doing something that would benefit people. People who just like go in and just like bully you into it, you know, that the message is not for them. And I have to understand that you cannot change everyone. And, it's what you do to the rest of the people.
I think that's a very important message, and something you've had to learn to throughout your career, is that you can't make everyone happy. You have to look at the individual impact you're making, you know, to people's lives. You know, you are changing individual people's lives. And that's a difference, right? These are people who go out into their communities, speak to their families, their friends, you know, like it's very important.
Absolutely. And then at the end of the day, people who just like make fun of like or criticize or bully you, at the end of the day, they are like doing the same thing for years, just bullying and making fun and trying to criticize you. But at the end of the day, I turn that thing that they make fun of into three business opportunity. It's like a new business venture. I'm doing already a show on a network, and I'm in talk with one of the biggest network in Egypt, and not in Egypt, sorry, in the Middle East, in order to launch a very unique show that is related to that I'm going to announce it when it's time. So let them keep on talking, you know. We're achieving something. Well, the only thing that they're achieving is just like five likes on their comments.
And do you feel that this whole venture is kind of the intersection of Dr. Bassem Youssef and entertainer Bassem Youssef?
It could be. It's kind of like I'm putting my medical knowledge into it, and I'm putting entertainment as I learned into it. And I think medicine is a hard pill to swallow. I mean, I think that's the best analogy you can use. But if you can use entertainment, that people will actually come to realize that maybe they can do a change in their lives. And at the end of the day, it is what you're making something that people would benefit from. And as I mentioned earlier, the impact that this show had done in a very short time was great. So that's what keeps me going.
I was gonna follow up on that just the show question. So is your new show, are you gonna be filming it from Los Angeles, or are you actually going to be in the United Arab Emirates for it?
So the plant-based diet show that I do on El Sharq, we shot the half of the show in Los Angeles, and we're doing the second half in Dubai. It's still a studio show, but like we're going in Dubai because we have good success stories there on the plant-based diet that we want to feature.
Did you expect to be approached by something such as El Sharq for a show like this?
I was surprised, but I think, especially that El Sharq is a kind of a business channel. El Shark is a kind of like the Arab version of Bloomberg. But I think they wanted something to kind of make a splash and boost their viewership at the beginning. And at the end of the day, it kind of fit because health and is a big part of business. You know, at the end of the day, it is business. And we are going to actually produce some episodes about the meat industry and the animal farming and the new meat alternative. All of that is business. But at the end of the day, habits and trends are at the end of the day it's business. So I was surprised, but I think it worked very well. They were quite happy with the results. It is the highest viewed shows in their channel, which is great. And hopefully we're going to continue doing more.
That's incredible. I think that's a testament to the reach you'll be able to achieve going forward.
Yeah.
On, you know, such an important topic. And I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing, especially a newer generation, starting to adopt a plant-based diet. And I know we discussed it a little earlier about jokes being made in Egypt and whatnot, but I do think a lot of Egyptian cuisine generally is fairly plant-based.
It is. The Middle Eastern cuisine is very, very, very plant-based, by the way. You know, if you look at all of the vegetables that we eat, يعني من أول ملوخية لبسلة لبامية لكلام من ده وبعدين فول وطعمية even the Lebanese cuisine, you know, you just like, if you remove the meat, it's plant-based. The kosheri, العدس, كل الكلام ده. And people now are actually realizing that like when they get older, they need to take care of their bodies. And even if they don't go plant-based 100%, they make changes in their diet. So if you, and I always say any change is good. People have a lot of difficulties and they ask me, Bassem, what should I do? I give them one advice, like quit dairy. Just keep the meat, keep the fish, keep everything. Quit one.
Dairy is the worst.
Yeah, quit dairy, but you have, but dairy means like no yogurt, no cheese, which is, the cheese is much difficult to quit than meat, by the way, for many people. But, and I said like, quit that and just like, and see how you feel. If you feel better, continue, you know? So I just like to make people like tell them to do it on their own terms, on their own time, and try as. And then I said, any change is good.
I think that applies to many things. You just need to start somewhere. You know, take small steps and baby steps. You know, eventually, before you know it, those baby steps will become giant steps, and then your whole life will have changed. Where do you find your Egyptian cuisine fix in the U.S.? At home? Outside home?
yeah. My wife is a great cook. but it's kind of sometimes trying to find the right kind of food, you know, and to try to, and then we have a slow cooker and we try to do it. And I have to say also my food preferences has also changed a lot. So in the El Brinamig, I was called the garbage can of the show because I would eat everybody else's food. I would eat anything, but now I can't. I was like Rim Ram, as they say. But I can't do that anymore.
I think that's, the fool comment reminded me, because I grew up overseas most of my life. I've moved around a lot. But I remember watching Fulusin Lazim as a kid and really resonating, you know, it really resonated with me because that was my food, right? Like that's a food I got overseas all the time. But I never realized the quality difference until you're actually in Egypt.
Yeah, exactly.
And trying, you know, food from the street.
can you also feel any difference in terms of food habit changes and mental health? Maybe
we actually, it's funny that you said that. We just released an episode on El Shark about mental health and diet. And we talk about emotional eating, and we talk about stress, and we talk about depression, and we talk about like how food is sometimes a gateway for people to or like a method for people to kind of overcome their anxiety. And that's why it's called comfort food, the food that is very rich in sugar or in oil. It's called comfort food because it makes me, it kind of activates certain centers in the brain to make you happy. But unfortunately, the food that makes you happy is usually not good for you. It's the food that's very high in sugar or in oil. And that's and we discussed about like how people kind of take use food as a crutch in order to overcome their mental problem or their, you know, emotional problem. And that's why the word emotional eating comes in play. And we had a whole episode about it, and we had doctors talking about it.
How do you teach your kids about this? Like, I imagine it's like, you know, yes, maybe as a kid you just kind of do what your parents do, but how do you, like, do you teach them the health benefits, the mental health benefits, or is it more like we eat plant-based because, you know, that's what we do in our family?
No, we tell them, you know, again, you know, people say kids are difficult. They are, but at the end of the day, they will eat what you eat. If it's the availability in your pantry, in your fridge, are plant-based, they will eat what you eat, you know? And they understand, you know, that this is healthier, it's better for you. And we don't push it. I mean, so if they're in a birthday and my daughter wants to eat a cake, I'm not going to stop her, you know? I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. You know, I don't want them to be deprived.
So I think that brings us to the, you know, near the end of our chat. Before we move on, are there any messages that you would want to give to people who are listening to this, whether they're in Egypt, whether they're in the US, whether they're, you know, interested in plant-based and diets and learning more about that lifestyle, or, you know, interested in comedy? What are there any messages that you'd give them?
Well, I think it's a message that I need to remind myself with the messages basically is that it's never too late to try something new. Mm-hmm. And it's never too late to try to reinvent yourself. And it's never too late to try to venture into uncharted territory. It is scary and it's uncertain, but sometimes it's worth it. And I also, the other thing is that measuring success is not really just by viewership or by clicks or by shares. It is you excelling into something that you never thought it was possible before. People say, like, don't you miss when 40 million people watch you on the show? Yes, I do. But it's not, that is not just like my life. I did it. I excelled in it. It's done. It's behind me. I can actually do other things now. So don't lock yourself in, or basically don't kind of limit yourself into one thing and think that's the only mean, or that's the only shape or the only form of success. There are many forms of success, and you'll be surprised if you give yourself the opportunity to unleash that potential.
I think you've been a really, really great example of reinvention because you've been a lot of different versions of yourself, and I think that this leads to fulfillment, and fulfillment is not just the one goal that you fulfill and then you get complacent. And I think that this is a really great example.
I'm listening to this personally, I find it motivating. Like, I find it, you know, like, there's often things I want to try, whether it's learning, you know, to play guitar or learning a new language. I'm like, I can do it if I just, you know, start with those small steps. You know, you just need to start somewhere and, you know, commit to it and see it through. That would actually make me, like, sorry, just a final maybe question before we move on to the next final round. Does failure mean anything to you? Like, do you believe in failure, or?
No, failure is nothing to believe in. Failure is a matter of fact. And you will fail. And I failed a lot. And many nights when I would do comedy, I failed, and it's fine. It is part of it. And if you don't fail, you never know how to move on. Because if you're only used to success, you're not gonna understand what failure means and what does it mean to reposition yourself or reroute or try something new to make yourself better.
You won't get out of your comfort zone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, we can start with the fire round questions. So I'll just ask you some quick questions and you'll tell me some quick answers. Okay, so who's your favorite comedian?
George Carlin.
Favorite plant-based Egyptian dish?
Lucheya.
Favorite California dish?
Vegan tuna wrap, which is made by jackfruit, which is incredible, and it could not distinguish from normal tuna.
Okay, very California. Someone who inspires you?
My wife, I have to say, because she has to deal with a lot with the kids and with the house. So I don't know how she do it.
And last but not least, what's your go-to hobby or stress relief?
I work out in the gym. That's my daily drug, basically.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. And thank you for taking the time. It's really been a joy.
That concludes today's episode. Thank you so much to our guest, Bassem Youssef, for joining us today, and my co-hosts, Mohammed Khairat and Amina Zainuddin. Bassem is a household name, and it was really exciting to have him today. What did you guys think?
I think, like, I'm still a bit wonderstruck, I guess, that we had this conversation with Bassem Youssef. I personally found him very down to earth. It was quite easy to have a conversation with him. And it was also quite interesting to learn more about how he's reinvented himself. That to me is an important story, and I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from all of this.
Yeah, I have to say wonderstruck is a pretty good word for me as well, because I have always been quite a big fan of Bassem Youssef because I've done a bit of research on political satire and its value and what it represents and how it can add to like a more varied way of consuming information and consuming news. And it's really interesting that I actually, through this conversation, got to know other and different and new sides of him. He's a really fascinating person. And it was, like you said, so easy to converse with him. He was very open and it was a really great conversation.
Yeah, I totally agree with you guys. And I found the conversation to be really inspiring, especially towards the end when he was talking about how he like persevered in changing so many different careers or like different vocations. And I found that really inspiring, especially for someone like him who's like, I think we all regard really highly.
And I think one thing that's particularly inspiring and that's come up in a number of the episodes of the podcast so far is, you know, we're speaking to all these incredibly accomplished individuals, but when you speak to them in this context, you just realize, you know, it could be your friend, you know, it could be just someone sitting next to you on the couch. And I think that's what's inspiring the most, that this, we can achieve this ourselves. Like, anyone can go out there and chase something they're passionate about and put in the effort and get somewhere with it.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And kind of when someone is really well known, you kind of think of them as just this character that you see on TV, but then you realize, like you're saying, that he's a person like all of us, and he's managed to do all of these things. So it is quite inspiring, and it can be quite encouraging to try to explore all the different ways that each of us can reinvent ourselves.
And it's a great reminder, too, of the pressures these individuals face, right, in the public spotlight, which is something that came up with Bassem Youssef in relation to his comedy and what people expected of him as well.
Absolutely.
Egyptian Streets is a podcast produced for the independent online publication at egyptianstreets.com. The show is edited and produced by Noron Morsi. Production support from the Egyptian Streets team. Our theme music is The Zeppelin by Blue Dot Sessions. Tune in to the Egyptian Streets podcast every other Sunday, and don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. I'm Noron Morsi.